And now, Forward with Falk. Join Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen as they navigate their way through the political thicket. Dave, this is the 75th anniversary of the end of World War II, the victory of the Allies over the fascists. A war that was at the time really the most destructive, vicious war in the history of humankind. And, of course, we've had many wars since then. And you could say that we're involved in a war at this minute, even though we're not fighting a state structure, but we're fighting for our lives against a virus. And we've suffered over 5 million casualties, if you consider people permanently injured and people who were killed by this thing. It looks like at this moment, 200,000 have died in America, and 5,200,000 cases with 5,300,000 permanent disabilities. That's a hell of a story. And if you compare the way this leadership, the Trump leadership, is fighting this war with the way FDR and that leadership fought that war, it was as if FDR would have told his armies, every platoon for itself, may the best man win. Because that's exactly what Trump did when he concluded that only Democrats and only people in Democratic-run cities were menaced by this virus, so why should he do anything? And we have the messages, we have the memos from his people saying just exactly that. So that I mention all of this because the Democrats finally put their ticket together and they nominated Kamala Harris to be Biden's running mate. And maybe this is a long way around of getting to that, but I think we have to talk about that because the leadership that we currently have is threatening to destroy America altogether. They may be collaborators, just like Pétain was a collaborator, Vichy France was a collaborator. This fellow, Trump and his collaborators, may be collaborators with this un-American virus.
Yeah, well, there's two things going on. You know, you mentioned really the lack of leadership and unity that Trump has engendered here. And also the fact that in some ways he's personalized what's happening and taking it as a personal affront. And because he takes personal affronts so badly, he's trying to treat it as though it's something that he can bully or lie to or pretend doesn't, you know, really exist, or is something that people should not pay attention to because he thinks it reflects badly on him, rather than doing the right thing, which is to try to unify everybody to fight this thing, you know, and secure as quick a victory as possible. He's prolonged the disaster. And, you know, you mentioned Kamala Harris. You have what the Democrats have done, is which is try to unify their ticket. You know, in some ways, her selection is very unsurprising. Of course, the GOP isn't taking it well, and Trump isn't taking it well. But it showed that the Democrats are willing to put together some an organization or, you know, at the top of the ticket that will represent America. You have a man and a woman. Don't forget that the majority of Americans are women. You have a white man and a woman of color. You know, people of color between the you know, blacks and Hispanics, and in Kamala Harris's case, Asian Americans, Indo-Americans, they represent at least half of the country now, if not most. And, of course, what we know is over the last 4 years that the whole appeal of Trump and the GOP has been to try to maintain the power of the whites, as they are a vanishing majority and going into the let's say the plurality of America, but not the majority of America. And this white identity that we talked about, I think it was last week with Stuart Stevens' book, about how the GOP has been playing on this for half a century or so. All of these factors are in the mix here. This week the Democrats are going to, I can't say going to Wisconsin, they're going to virtual Wisconsin. I got my stuff from the convention.
You're a delegate, right?
I'm an alternate delegate.
So what does that mean, that you get to go to Clark Summit?
Yeah. Well, even the delegates are only getting to go to Clark Summit.
Right.
There's an article in the Scranton Times. I could have. I would get to go to the convention, but I would not have a vote.
Uh-huh.
Is in essence what it was. And if somebody had to leave the convention, I would take their place.
Well, you and I got to go to the last convention, but we didn't have votes. So there you go.
Right. Right. But
you haven't improved your status.
Yeah. Well, the only thing that improved was my vote count in the primary. but no. But those are, in some ways, it's an exciting thing. America right now is experiencing a huge dislocation because people can't get together. We're talking about whether or not they can go to restaurants, and if so, what capacity. We're talking about jobs. Workplaces, can they get together? We're seeing a lot of companies saying we're just going to maintain online work, people working from home rather than from headquarters. That's having a tremendous effect on real estate and things like that. We're seeing people now, we're getting ready to go to school. Schools are starting and they're closing down because the virus, as soon as you get people in close proximity, it expands. And they're talking about sports in professional and in the schools, college football and all of those things are happening. But we're used to getting together, and when we were in Philadelphia 4 years ago, we saw how you can you can intermingle and you can do things and rub shoulders with people that you see on television and real life stuff. And now we're in a virtual world where things are kind of separated. They're more connected in some ways because of a thing like Zoom that's only appeared in the last year or so. But on the other ways, you're disconnected from that personal touch type of thing.
But let's face it, the Trump administration, the Trump gang, they destroyed the economy. They destroyed the educational system. They saw to it that 66 million American workers were thrown out, lost their jobs. We still have 13 million of them who haven't gotten their jobs back, plus the others who are normally unemployed, more millions. 200,000 were killed. 5.8 million with lifetime permanent damages to their hearts, their lungs, their ability to think. He just laid the country waste. You can't imagine that the pattern of life that we remembered from a year ago is the pattern of life that's going to resume in the coming months, because we haven't conquered this disease yet.
No, I mean, it's a mass dislocation. It's in effect, we start talking about World War II, what happened. Things never go back to where they were.
That's right.
We have yet to see the secondary and tertiary ways things are playing out. Are people going to, continue to live in cities? They're going to expand to the suburbs. Remember, after World War II, we had all the building into the suburbs. Long Island, which had been mostly agricultural, what was it, a potato patch that became Levittown, things like that.
But that was all racism. That was all whites running away from black Americans who came up from the South.
I was just going to say that New York Times ran a piece this week, I think it's running this weekend, about how Bill Levitt was able to secure federal loans for this and insure it. And the federal government made sure that it was only, it was essentially going to be an all-white undertaking.
Well, the story of the suburb is the story of attempting to keep all-white communities all-white. That's what the suburbs were. That's was the whole rationale. Yeah. By the way, that was the rationale for condominiums. Make sure that blacks can't move in next door by buying the building and keeping them out. Buying the apartment, keeping them out.
And
when people talk about institutional racism, that's the kind of thing they're talking about, even if they don't know it.
Yeah, and of course, the secondary effects of that was that blacks could not build wealth because in many cases, the greatest asset that white people had was their homes and the appreciation of value of their homes. When you forced people out of that market, you redlined them, or you kept them in areas where they weren't depreciating. You had these problems, and of course, again, you get back to the GOP versus the Democrats.
Well, you get back to Trump, who says, yes, "I'm going to make sure blacks won't move into the suburbs."
Suburbs, yeah, overtly. And don't forget, he and his father were cited and paid
three
a fine
times,
for keeping people
out. His father was a Klan member. There are pictures of his father in Klan uniform. He sometimes denies it, but it's hard to deny those pictures.
Yeah. So we had all of that. We have all of that. And you know, we also have to talk about, when you talk about the end of World War II, the building of institutions in a different way, not just domestic, but internationally, to try to prevent another massive war from happening. You had the UN, you had the Monetary Fund, you had the Marshall Plan, which rebuilt things. The treaty organizations like NATO, that Trump is trying to destroy. All of these things really, in effect, they didn't fully keep the peace. You know, you had the wars in Korea and Vietnam, but you didn't have the mass conflagrations for years and years. And of course, Trump has no understanding of history on this, and really doesn't care about whether the political form of government is democratic or not, or whether it's authoritarian or not.
Well, you're making an interesting point there, because, you know, since World War II, the great argument of the American government about the American system is free elections. That's the hallmark, the keystone, the capstone of freedom, according to what the American government's organs of propaganda constantly put out. The Venezuelan government is no good, because no free elections. This or that government is no good because no free elections. And here's Trump now saying, we can't have voting by mail, and we're going to shut down the post office to prevent voting by mail. Because, why? Republicans can't win such an election. So where does 75 years of trumpeting free elections as the hallmark of freedom, where does that leave the American government if Trump remains the leader of the American government?
Yeah, well, but I think the more interesting part of that, you know, obviously we know what he is. You know, he's an authoritarian. He admires all of these people, from Putin to the head of the Philippines to the guy down in Brazil and to Erdogan in Turkey. You know, these are his heroes. Xi in China, president for life, you know, that kind of thing appeals to him. But the more interesting thing that we've been observing, I think, and more perhaps more lastingly consequential, or I could be wrong on this, is the abrogation of the Republican Party, of their constitutional duty and everything that they claim to stand for. I mean, they're the party that waved the flag time and time again. They were the ones that said, we stand up. They saw communists where communists didn't even exist. You know, they're the ones standing up to for this, you know, apple pie and, you know, motherhood and all of this stuff. And their silence on most of these issues is overwhelming.
Well, it goes even further now, because in the last primary election, just a few weeks ago, a woman was elected to take the candidate seat for the House in Georgia, 14th Congressional District, I think, in Georgia, who is an anti-Semite, a racist, and a believer in QAnon, the preposterous belief that the FBI says is a probably terrorist organization, a belief that the government is controlled by a pedophilic gang of Democrats who are out to do I don't know exactly what. And she's determined to make sure that this gets exposed and these people get arrested. Why that fella ran to the pizza parlor in Washington to liberate the kids who were being held in this basement of the pizza parlor. Of course, the pizza parlor had no basement.
Yeah. Well, you know, and she's going to go to Congress because she's in a safe Republican district. There's
14 of them, apparently, not as outspoken QAnon followers as she, but enough to form a caucus in the Congress. And the Republicans do not, they're all Republicans. And the Republican leadership not only does not disown them, it says they will give them committee assignments, which they don't have to do.
Yeah. And we thought Louie Gohmert was the worst thing in Congress.
Yeah, can you imagine a week in which Louie Gohmert comes out to be a relatively benign figure, the most ignorant man ever elected to the Congress?
I mean, you know, we had Ted Yoho and Virginia Fox, that whole crew with the nutty stuff. But this, you know, these folks are actually dangerous. That's things that have been going on and what have you. But, we really got to get back to the U.S. mail thing because, you know, this is something that goes right to the heart of the Constitution. The mail is authorized under Article 1, Section 7 or Section 8 of the Constitution. The Congress shall make, has the power to make a post office and, interestingly, postal roads. Not just that, but something to expedite the mails. Ben Franklin, one of his great things was that he was the first postmaster general. It was such an important thing, and it is something that is very, very important to a lot of people for a lot of reasons, particularly, ironically, in red states. I heard Joe Manchin this week talking about the fact that what Trump has done, he put one of his henchmen in charge of the post office, and they're slowing the mail down because they're cutting back on overtime. They're taking out equipment, overtly taking out, and I understand destroying equipment like mail sorters, just so to be able to slow things down. At one place, they took out mail sorters while things were being sorted, and they left 80,000 pieces of mail unsorted just to fill these commands. But Joe Manchin says, hey, in West Virginia, people rely on this stuff. They get their diabetics to get their medication through the mail. The post offices are where people meet and get together. And if you get a conservative Democrat like Joe Manchin saying that we can't tolerate this, in Montana they had a big to-do where they were literally picking up post office or mailboxes off the streets, and so people couldn't even mail things. There was such an uproar and to-do that late in the week, on Friday evening, the post office says, okay, we're going to stop taking away your mailboxes. But that was only in, you know, most of the western states. We still don't know what they're going to be able to force these folks to backtrack on.
Well, the post office issued a statement at the end of the week to the effect that they could not guarantee that in how many states? 26 states, that the ballots could be delivered to the election offices in time.
Yeah,
they're telling you up front, we're not going to let you vote by mail.
We're not going to let your vote count. And this has to do with two things. One, people who request mail-in votes later in the process is going to be delaying them getting them, and then, of course, getting them back. So I know in Pennsylvania, there have been some things that have been happening. Number one, there's a lawsuit about this, and a judge in Western Pennsylvania, I guess it's the Western District, gave the Trump administration only a couple of days to show why voter fraud actually exists through mail-in ballots. I haven't heard the results of whether they were able to prove anything or not, but this is a Trump judge.
How are they going to prove anything? There are no cases. Nobody's ever found any of it.
Yeah, I think in Oregon, where they've been doing mail-in ballots for like 15 or 20 years, all mail-in, they've had like 0.00003 number of problem cases, you know, in this. Because
if you recall, with all the talk about mail fraud, the only cases that have come up, there was one in Texas, a Republican was involved, and there was one in North Carolina, again, a Republican was involved.
Yeah, a guy was collecting ballots and filling them out himself.
Yeah, which you have to admit is efficient.
It is. But, you know, Putin's big thing is to, you know, I'm saying Putin's because Trump is really doing Putin's bidding here, is to say, you know, if we have the mail-in ballots, they're unreliable, and therefore, if Biden is elected, he's not a legitimate president. That's where they're going with this.
Right.
On that. And I hate to say it, but if you read some of the letters of the editor that were in the Scranton Times this week, you know, the Trumpsters are all in on it. They're willing to believe this stuff, and they're going to have that problem, even though the Biden is a likely winner at this stage, although it's not a sure thing.
You're making an important point here, because people assume that Biden will get elected, Trump will be defeated, the country takes a turn. Trump has got 30-35% of the registered voters supporting him. They're not going away if he gets defeated. What they will do, what he will get them to do, how they will behave, that's an open question that strikes me needs to be discussed so that measures can be taken now to make sure that they don't disrupt the country out of power as they have destroyed the country in power.
Yeah. One of the things, and I think I said it last week also, was part of the strategy is to come up with so many different affronts, so many different off-the-wall things, so many different assaults on democracy and on the rule of law that you can't keep up with them. You can't concentrate on one, and concentrating on one isn't sufficient. There's so many things. I noticed this week that Representative Eric Swalwell from California, who is one of the impeachment leaders in the Congress, said that what we need is a presidential crime commission if Trump loses, to try to put all this stuff together as to what's happening. Now, interestingly, one person that's going to put a lot of this together before the election stuff is Michael Cohen, who's presaged his book that's coming out in September with some interesting blurbs about the Trump methodology of working, you know, doing anything, as Cohen says, to win, legal or illegal. He says, I know where the skeletons are buried because I helped bury them. That's going to come out.
Cohen was the guy who arranged for the sex partners, who paid the sex partners, who enabled the tax frauds, carried them out together with that old fellow who was the accountant for the Trump organization, who intervened and organized the meetings with the corrupt officials in Russia. He did it all. He was there for all of it. He was the trusted consigliere, right?
Yeah. Now, the sex stuff is just the bling, you know, the shiny stuff. But really, you have to concentrate on the frauds.
The fraud.
And apparently, that's what's happening in New York. Cy Vance, and what they're doing, what they're looking at in the Trump business records. The Trump is desperately trying to keep out of the public's view or keep away from the prosecutors. There's going to be so much there that you know it's hard to imagine how it's when and if it comes, you know, how it's going to come out. Of course, the Supreme Court keeps putting things off till after the election. They're enabling. The question is whether or not they, when things start to really come out, when the dam bursts, whether they're going to say, look, we've done all we could. This is just too dirty even for us. or whether they're going to, you know, stick together. So far, that Alito, Thomas wing of the part of the Supreme Court seems to be sticking with the Trumpsters, and we'll have to see what happens there. But, you know, and again, you got to go back to what the GOP and the Senate is doing right now. They're all the ones that are up for re-election are running for their lives singly. And I'm kind of amazed that the Democrats haven't, although the Lincoln Project has, that the Democrats aren't just focusing in on those vulnerable seats now with ad after ad about the post office and things like that.
They certainly should be. And by the way, and did you notice that at the end of the week, the Inspector General announced that the people who Trump appointed to be the temporary head of the Department of Homeland Security and of the ICE are there illegally? They should not be in those positions?
Right.
Cuccinelli and Wolf?
Right, because these people haven't been Senate confirmed.
That's right. That's right.
And there's a lot of people that can't. There's a technicality in the law that people can serve for a certain amount of time if they've had a previous Senate approval. They can serve in another job for up to 180 days or something like that. But some of them haven't been approved at all. And
these are the guys who carry out the policies of separating families, putting kids in jail, sending the people to Oregon to intimidate protesters. Or not only Oregon, every city they can get their thugs into.
These are the equivalents of the SS apartheids, you know, who would go out and do the bidding.
That's right. These are the Eichmanns of the Trump administration.
Yeah, and it's hard to believe we're actually saying stuff like this in America, but it is now. You know, and again, I mentioned GOP senators. Mitt Romney came out this week and made a statement, but where are the rest of them? And again, the Democrats have to force their hand. What are they going to?
And when Trump accused Kamala Harris of being ineligible to serve as vice president, which of the Republican senators spoke up in defense of the 14th Amendment?
Certainly not Ted Cruz, who was born in Canada,
right?
To a Mexican father, to a Hispanic
Cuban father and an American mother, right?
Yeah, yeah. Of course, don't forget that Donald Trump's mother was born overseas. She's Brit. She's from the UK.
Well,
but that doesn't matter.
That doesn't count. Nothing counts.
Doesn't count.
So. Nothing counts. Meanwhile, we don't have Jerry Falwell Jr. to kick around anymore. He went the way of Jimmy Swaggart when he got caught with his pants down, and he posted the picture on Facebook.
Pants. Yeah, he's been teetering on that edge for a while. Liberty University's, you know, the kids that go there. The ones that really understand why they're going there have had some real reservations about him and the school for a while. They've been losing a certain amount of students, and so he's no different than the Franklin Grahams. The second generation doesn't fall far from the tree, or they're the same kind. Birds of a feather, I guess you'd call them.
Yeah,
and. You know, again, the hypocrite class we're all for morality as long as it doesn't affect us or our people in power.
Yeah.
The things that they would excoriate Democrats for, they give passes to Trump.
And when you're anointed, lots of things don't, you don't have to follow lots of problems, lots of laws, lots of anything. You're above it all. Anyway, that's the end of it for this week. We're going to have some interesting things coming up next week because the campaign gets hot and heavy.
Yeah, we have the convention and we'll have all the speeches and we'll be able to talk about them.
Yep. So I'll see you next week.
See you next week.
I'm sorry you didn't get to go to Milwaukee.
Oh, well. I can still drink a Milwaukee beer.
Bye now.
Bye.
You've been listening to Forward with Falk. Longtime Scranton political observer Dave Falk and WFTE's Jake Rosen discuss politics. Join them again next week, same time, same place. This program is supported by Argosy Bookshop of New York City. 116 East 59th Street, just down the block from Bloomingdale's. Old and rare books, prints and maps, members of the International League of Antiquarian Booksellers, founding members of the Antiquarian Booksellers Association of America, members of the Appraisers Association of America, on the web at Argosy Books, ArgosyBooks.com. Check them out for books, autographs, maps, and prints.